this portion of our seminar, I'm going to call Kant in Context. And essentially, I just want to give you some history so you might appreciate what transcendental argumentation is all about and what Van Til is hooking into. Clearly, Van Til was not a Kantian. In fact, he, in a sense, spent his scholarly career refuting Kant and post-Kantian ways of thinking, especially as they came to expression in neo-orthodoxy and other theological aberrations. Nevertheless, Kant's project, the kind of thing Kant was doing, becomes the heart of Van Til's way of defending the faith. And so I think it would be valuable for us to have an appreciation for the historical setting and what Kant himself said. Also give us some background for what Mike Butler is going to be doing with us tomorrow morning when we begin looking at contemporary transcendental argumentation and what the situation there is. So to put Kant in context, we're going to talk about his precursors, continental rationalism, as that was seen in the philosophies of Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. This school of thought is called continental because these three men were on the continent of Europe. Makes sense. And they were all rationalists because they agreed on some things that I'll give you in a minute that define the rationalist approach. But it isn't as though they had the Continental Rationalist Club and this association got together every once in a while and issued their journal or what have you, but they're all, in retrospect, lumped together. And then British empiricism, what makes this nice is we not only have a difference in point of view, but we also have a difference in geography, so we can remember it. And three philosophers here, Locke, Berkeley, and Hume. Locke being English, Berkeley Irish, and Hume Scottish. I think they must have gotten together and divided that up and said, okay, now in England we're going to have this point of view, in Ireland. No, this is, again, retrospective, but it is very convenient. So we can remember these. You have the rationalist approach, the empiricist approach, and then Kant comes along and offers us the transcendental approach or critical philosophy. And it's critical because he looks for the foundations of both rationalism and empiricism. He looks for the transcendentals that make it possible for us to reason both logically and empirically. Both rationalism and empiricism accepted the autonomous point of reference that is found in René Descartes' intellectual method. Descartes said, now what if I try to doubt everything that I can? Is there any way that I can come up with something that is beyond doubt? Can I answer the radical skeptic with any kind of indubitable? Is there anything that's beyond doubt? And he said, well, my existence is beyond doubt. Such a humble guy, this René Descartes, eh? Here's the one thing in the universe I'll tell you for sure, me. I think, therefore, I am. Which, as some critics later said, he could as well have said, I stink, therefore, I am. Because, after all, he has the I in the premise, and that's what he's trying to conclude. So, not much of an argument here. He was taking for granted his own existence when he argued for it. The point is that Descartes assumed man's intellectual self-sufficiency. Man can be his own starting point. There are a lot of things that are questionable about life, about things outside my mind, about the world. The one thing that's not questionable is me. I exist. I'm the point of reference. Everything finally is going to have to pass that standard. It's going to have to conform to what I know about me. Okay, so what I'm saying now is that the empiricist and the rationalist, and for that matter Kant too, they all assume the centrality of man. Now earlier when we did our light once over on different kinds of proofs, what did we say happens to them all? They reduce to what? Subjectivism and skepticism. Now why do you think that is? Because man is put at the center. Since everything pivots around man, his thinking, his authority, since he's the point of reference, it shouldn't surprise us that when you start criticizing, it reduces down to man himself, his point of view. And since that isn't absolute and beyond doubt, it reduces to skepticism. All right, so these are autonomous schools of thought. First of all, continental rationalism. The rationalists all agreed on two things. First, there are self-evident truths from which we can deduce substantial conclusions about reality. There are some truths that are so self-evident that from them we can deduce the nature of reality. And secondly, that we should search for certainty in our knowledge where mathematics is the ideal of knowledge. The rationalist wanted certainty, and it had to be certainty along the model of geometry or math. Well, we've already criticized, I mean, I'm going to say more about them, but we've already criticized this, haven't we? If these are self-evident truths, why did Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz arrive at radically different conclusions about reality? One was a dualist, one was a monist, one was an atomist, or a pluralist. Kind of strange if these are self-evident truths, isn't it? The rationalist had a supreme confidence in the intellect's ability to solve all human problems and to know reality, reality understood as something fundamentally rational. Now, because reality is rational, you can understand that education for them became the key to enlightenment. If you want to solve man's problems, men need to be educated. Now, we may not be continental rationalists in our culture today, but are we rationalists in that sense? Do we still naively think that education will solve man's problems? Yeah. And why not? If reality is fundamentally rational, and man's mind can be counted on with clear and distinct ideas to deduce the nature of reality, sure. Supreme confidence in the intellect's ability. A reliable method of reasoning begins, as I've already said many times, with clear and distinct ideas. Well, if the indubitability of these ideas is their clearness and distinctness to me, notice that indubitability is tied to an internal and subjectivistic reference point. It's something in me, not outside of me, and it's something subjective. For Descartes, whenever we encounter a property, so I'm looking at an apple and I encounter its redness. Whenever we encounter a property, there's an unperceived substance present. If any object of thought is multi-propertied, it has many properties, then there must be a substance that, quote-unquote, holds the properties together. Yes? Apples just aren't red, are they? They wouldn't be very satisfying if they were just red. They're also spherical. Well, roughly, spherical. They're also what? Crisp, sweet, tart, whatever. Well, why aren't all these things just loose and disjointed? Well, because the apple is a substance that has the properties red, sphericality, crispness, sweetness, what have you. So for Descartes, whenever we encounter a property, there must be an unperceived substance present. The key here is that the substance is unperceived. Has anybody ever seen the substantiality of an apple? Have you ever seen what binds the redness, crispness, sphericality? No, of course not. So in order to think clearly, I must assume that there's a substance. But I don't see a substance. I only see the properties of the alleged substance. According to Descartes, there are two different kinds of substance, mind and body substance. Some substances are not extended in space, like souls or minds. others, like apples and giraffes, are extended in space. Now, Spinoza also wants to deduce the nature of reality from clear and distinct ideas. By definition, Spinoza says, a substance which must be independent of other things, you know why it's independent is because the substance is what unites the properties, makes one apple different from another apple, right? You don't just have redness diffused through the world, sphericality diffused through the world. You have sphere, red, crisp, so forth, all together in this one independent substance. But Spinoza says, if by definition a substance is independent, then there can only be one substance. There can only be one independent thing. If there are two things, then they're conditioned by each other. The rationalists don't get a lot of good press in America. But when you think about it, that's a pretty brilliant argument. I mean, he says, look, conceptually, you're committed to being... If independence is a mark of substance, then there can only be one. Ultimately, there's only one substance. And therefore, all is one. And what we call everything, the substance of reality, is nature. He says, or if you have a religious bent, you can call it God. That's just kind of different vocabulary for the same thing. And therefore, for him, physics and psychology are deductive sciences. They are not sciences where you go out and observe empirically and learn about the world, but you can deduce the nature of the world, knowing that it's one substance and that you have clear and distinct ideas about your experience. Leibniz uses Spinoza's starting point that a substance is independent, and he draws the opposite conclusion. Since substance is independent, then there must be a plurality of independent things that don't have any relationship to one another. That's what makes them independent. Let me put it to you this way. For Spinoza, the independence of substance is gained by everything depending on it. For Leibniz, the independence of substance is gained by nothing interacting with anything. And so he said reality is made up of a number of, quote, windowless monads. They're windowless because you can't see and have any interaction with anything else. It's a monad.
So, to make sure, would you say then that maybe Spinoza was focusing in on the one, Leibniz was focusing in on the many?
Yes. I would, yeah, that's exactly right. But they begin with common premises and they end up with radically different conclusions about reality. Now, you will appreciate this, even if you don't like these guys so far and they confuse you. Both of them were eventually dismissed as dream philosophers who had gained coherence and experience in an artificial way. By their artificial conceptions of unity or independent pluralities, they had coherence, but it was all a dream a dream philosophy sort of thing. You could easily understand then why the British empiricists wanted to get away from all the abstruse speculations of the continental philosophers.
In another sense, though, they both are also emphasizing the one and many, in the sense that they both have a rational change, and yet you press on it and it becomes irrational. Right.
Yes.
In one sense, you can say the one with atomistic was emphasizing the many. The other sense, Spinoza is emphasizing the one with component. In the other sense, they both have a one and a many aspect.
Mm-hmm. All philosophies do.
Okay.
Right.
What was their answer for bringing it together?
Well, in the case of Spinoza, there's nothing to bring together. It's all the same thing. How do you...
You want me to understand that, don't you?
Well, not a lot. I mean, if you do, that would be better, but I don't have a real thirst to make people understand Spinoza because I'm not sure I altogether understand him. But what he would tell you is you don't have to worry about uniting mind and body, concept and percept, because they're just different ways of talking about the same thing. For him, the discussion of psychology, the discussion of physics, are just like English and German talking about the same thing. You talk in different language, but you're talking about the same thing because all is one. There's one basic substance. For Leibniz, he gets unity among all of his windowless monads by having a grand monad. True. That's what he calls God, the big monad, the grand monad. And God organizes all the monads so they don't run into each other, you know, they work together. You think I'm kidding you. You think I'm making this up. It's called the doctrine of pre-established harmony. The grand monad has pre-established the harmony of all monads. Mike, am I lying about this? I'm telling you, I wouldn't do that for you. This was what Leibniz said.
Read monadology.
Yeah, that's right. That's why people dismiss this as a dream philosophy. It's just silliness. You know what? I'm very sympathetic, not to the over-general way he did this, but given what he had read, you can understand why David Hume said, gather all the books on metaphysics and consign them to the flames. He did. He was a librarian, by the way. Hume said, get all those books written by those nuts over there in Europe and burn them. Because it's ridiculous. Okay. Now, we all, you know why we laugh at that, by the way? We all have a certain conception of what it is to think correctly, and we find this silly. The European mindset at that time was really, you know, they thought that was very respectable stuff. But the British and then eventually the American tradition doesn't warm up to that kind of speculation. I'm sure that I've used this example with people before that are here. But it always gets the point across, and so I'm going to repeat it. If you want to understand the difference between European philosophy, British philosophy, and then American philosophy, imagine that you have an elephant on a barge just a little bit offshore, and the question is, how do you get the elephant to shore? Three different approaches. The European philosopher will say, well, is the elephant real? The British philosopher will say, how much does the elephant weigh? And the American philosopher will say, how much will you pay me? And that's wildly overgeneral. But the point is, European philosophy tended to be much more abstract. British philosophy is tied to a more scientific approach. And realistically, American philosophy is oriented toward pragmatism. Get it done. What will you pay me? So we don't like, well, Descartes probably the most popular of the continental rationalists. Spinoza and Leibniz don't have a lot of followers. In the 60s, they had a few, but in the 60s, there were a lot of weird things going on with psychedelic music and drugs, too. So, you know, let's move on to, that wasn't meant to be ad hominem. It was meant to be explanatory. British empiricism. The empiricists all said, there are no innate ideas. They said, only particulars exist. That's the second thing. And thirdly, we should seek common sense in observation and practicality. Our intellectual method should seek to be commonsensical, being based on observation and seeking practicality. There are no innate ideas. Do we know that empirically? Uh-oh. The empiricist says everything we know, we know on the basis of sensation. But there are no sensations that will justify there are no innate ideas. Is empiricism presuppositionalist and neutral then? No, empiricism is a dogma, as Quine put it. Not on this particular point, related, but empiricism is prejudiced. It begins with a philosophical assumption, and then after that says, no more philosophical assumptions, thank you. There are no more sophisticated empiricists. I'm not kidding you. There aren't. Well, I am right. There are no more sophisticated empiricists. There still are naive empiricists. They're all in the evangelical church, though. I'm not kidding you. I'm not saying that to be mean. The only people I know that defend naive empiricists are evangelical evidentialists. some of you are philosophy majors and graduate. Am I putting anybody on? I don't know anybody that defends a kind of pure empiricism anymore. There are people who defend empirical methods as the model of rationality and all. But the idea that there are no innate ideas, people account for innate ideas differently. Conventionalists, linguistic conventionalists, behaviorists, so forth. But you couldn't know anything if there wasn't cognitive background that you bring to your experience. All observations are theory dependent. And I think that's the reigning view in epistemology today. Secondly, empiricism says only particulars exist. Well, if only particulars exist, notice there can be no unity among the particulars, because unity itself is not a particular. There can't be kinds of things, because a kind of thing, let's say duckness or appleness, a kind of thing is not particular, it's universal. And if there are no connecting principles between things, then we can't even say that an apple is an apple. Because to say that something is an apple is to assume substance, that the properties are united somehow, are indexed together as an apple. But you don't see the indexing of properties. You don't see them united in any conceptual way, or even by way of natural laws. Not only is there no substance, if only particulars exist, there can be no causality. Because you can have a particular event and another particular event, but you can't ever say there's a necessary connection between those two events. So you can't ever say anything is causally related. John Locke, the first of the British empiricists that I put up on the board for you, said that the substance that we think about that individuates things and unites properties, substance, he said, is a substratum for qualities. It's something that underlies the qualities, like a pincushion underlies the pins that are in it. Properties are like pins that are in the substance, the pincushion. But when pushed, Locke said, openly said, substance is, and I quote, I know not what. That's hyphenated. He wasn't saying, I don't know what substance is. He was saying that. But the point is, substance is a mysterious, metaphysical thing. It's an I know not what. But he felt that he had to have that. Now, in passing about Locke, no innate ideas, but when it came to political theory, this is what Locke is known for by most American school children, right? Or high school children, anyway. What did Locke teach? The doctrine of? Well, private property as an inalienable right. There are no innate ideas, but there are inalienable rights. So if you want a homework assignment, go home tonight and see if you can bring those two together in your worldview. An inalienable right, how can it be inalienable if it's not innate? You know, so it's pretty tough to get all this together. Well, I want to move on, though. Locke saw substance as I know not what. Berkeley argued that to be is to be perceived, and therefore there are no abstract ideas, he said. Nothing exists in abstraction. Everything that exists is concrete, and it must be perceived to exist. However, matter is an unperceived abstract idea. Has anybody ever perceived matter? Now don't tell me you've perceived things that are material. That isn't what we're asking. The property of materiality may be there concretely in some things, but the idea of matter is abstract. Material substance is unperceived and therefore doesn't exist. And so according to him, there is no material reality. Well, what about materiality? I said there's no material reality. What about that property of materiality? like that, you know. Johnson once thought that he refuted Berkeley by kicking a stone. I mean, that's laughable, because if you understand the argument, he didn't deny that we have sensations. But stop and think about it. The stone doesn't have sensations, does it? Why doesn't the stone have sensations? Because it doesn't have a mind. Sensations are interpretations. Okay? And so, in order to have a sensation must be in a mind. So even sensations of materiality are mind-dependent. There is no material reality. All reality is mental reality. And that's why you have this odd combination in Berkeley of a man who is an empiricist but an idealist. He takes empirical presuppositions and pushes them to idealistic conclusions about the nature of reality. Well, Hume comes along and he says, well, I can do you an even greater favor. You've gotten rid of Descartes' material substance. If we're going to be really honest empiricists, we have to get rid of mental substance too. And earlier we talked about this. There's nothing that gives unity to my perceptions. I'm nothing but a bundle of perceptions, and even that's cheating to say that. For Hume, in order for something to exist, it has to be traced to a sensation. That's the empirical approach. No innate ideas are going to help us here. And we never have any sensations of connecting principles between our experiences. We don't have any psychological connecting principles, and therefore there's no me, there's no continuing personal identity, and we don't have any perception of physical connecting principles, and therefore there's no causation in the world. There's just one random event followed by another random event. Every experience is a separate, isolated unit of consciousness. There's no necessity in the world of thought or experience, sensation, and there's no necessity in the world that is outside the mind. And so there's no basis for a knowledge of the external world of enduring objects, no basis for a knowledge of causality among objects, nor is there a continuing self that could know the causation between objects. Now, what would you call this view if you wanted to just choose a term out of the history of philosophy? How about skepticism? Boy, that's radical. How did Hume deal with his skepticism? Yeah, well, actually, he said when he gets working on these problems and they really get him down, he stops and he plays backgammon with his friends. I'm so glad that he said that. He must have thought he was being real smarty, you know, to say that sort of thing. But that is such an honest admission. That's our culture, my friends. When you get tired of the philosophical problems Monday through Friday, you know, at the SC Philosophy Hall, you go home and party. That's what you do. You go to football games and watch movies and think about your kids, and then you go back on Monday and you start all over again. It's two different worlds, and they cannot be brought together. Hume admitted that we do think causally, but he said there's no rational basis for it. That's why he's a skeptic.
So why didn't you just stop?
Stop what?
Why?
Wouldn't you rather go home and party and go to football games and stuff?
It just seems to me it would be so obvious to him that what he's doing contradicts what he's teaching.
Contradicts in a world where there's no connections between things? Now, I'm not putting you on. I'm trying to help you see what Hume would be able to say and what unbelievers say. When you challenge unbelieving philosophers today about these things and you get them all balled up intellectually, they're essentially going to cop out on you like that. You're going to say, well, why don't you live, you're using Christian presuppositions, why don't you live consistent with your philosophy? And their answer is, there's no consistency anyway, so why worry about it? I do what pleases me. And it pleases me to continue living, you know, to enjoy a little bit of Jack Daniels and, you know, the party lifestyle or whatever, and then to make a living telling students you can't make any sense out of anything. I'm overgeneralizing, but not terribly. Our assumption is people are going to live in terms of their philosophy. Their assumption is we have no moral obligations at all. Not even a moral obligation to live in terms of our philosophy. And I mean, this is a perverse kind of consistency, but do you see the consistency of the unbeliever? I want to tie this in with Van Til. Van Til says, if you're going to play the explanation-giving game, you have to be a Christian. And you want an explanation for why you believe one thing and you do another. And basically what he's going to say is, there is no explanation.
Is there a reason why when you mentioned the empiricists, when I went to school, they taught, they gave the unreliability of sense data. You have a hot bowl of water, cold bowl of water, you put your hands in both. Then you put it in the third common bowl and it feels hot for one, it feels cold for the other.
Right.
What, you didn't bring up, when you, in your quick critique of the three,
yes.
Okay.
I mean, you have to kind of order, you think, the most devastating criticisms down to the... And I would say that is a little below midway. That's not the most telling criticism. But it... Well, but you see, the answer to that is you need an objective way of measuring, quote-unquote, not a subjective way of measuring. And that's why we use... That's why we have thermometers, exactly. I mean, there's other problems about... What's that?
How do you come back to that?
How do I come back to it?
No, no, no. Say, okay, yeah, well, we get an objective measure of the sensation, you know, an independent thing. And so, in other words, what they're trying to come, the way they're trying to answer that is that, oh, yes, but there is an independent objective standard for sensation. Is that what they're trying to do, I guess?
Yes.
Oh, you know, it's obvious to use a thermometer.
Yeah, they are, but again, no sophisticated philosopher uses that argument. You know, why? I mean, think about it, Bill. If I'm going to be a radical, I mean, it's fun being a radical skeptic. Now, I'm going to say, what's the connection between the measurement on the thermometer and this hand and this hand? Obviously, what you have here is three different measurements, and there's no connection between them. Yeah, exactly. See, they're assuming that if we can depersonalize it, that makes it objective. But now there's a what's the relationship between the impersonal and the personal measuring devices? Okay. The problem in epistemology is the problem of perspectival variation. Okay, you're out on the lake and you're, you know, you have your oars, you're rowing on the lake, and you look in the water at the oar, what do you see? You see a bent oar, don't you, because of the refraction of light in the water. But then you say, wow, what happened to that oar? And you put your hand in the water and you skim down the oar and you say, no, it feels straight. So you look at it and it's broken, not broken, but bent. You touch it and it feels straight. And you say, oh, okay, well, that solves it. That solves it only if you arbitrarily exalt tactile sense over visual sense, right? Yeah, exactly. So there are...